Crime in the City, our summer series about crime novelists and the cities they write about, takes us to one of the great cities in the world this morning. For millions of tourists who flock to Athens, Greece every year, the city at the foot of the Acropolis represents the cradle of democracy and the sublime art of antiquity. To crime writer Petros Markaris, the Athens of today represents all that stuff, but is also a symbol of the ugliness of modern corrupt societies. And if you doubt that, I have some Greek bonds to sell you. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli recently spoke with Markaris about his novels and the financial and social crises sweeping his country.
A musician plays in one of the few quiet spots on Adriano, the pedestrian street that winds its way around the foot of the Acropolis. Suddenly, we're in Monastiraki, bustling with colorful street stalls and old-fashioned shops. It's one of Petros Markaris' favorite places.
It still has something oriental. You still smell the spices, etc.
The bazaar.
The bazaar, right. This is part of the town where the ancient Greece and the Ottoman Empire meet.
Markaris uses Athens as a central character of his novels, but he acknowledges a love-hate relationship as he describes the modern city of more than 5 million people as seen from the top of Lycabettus Hill.
What do you see? Something like a hell. Everything built without any planning, without any controls, without nothing. And in between you see the streets with some insects going slowly along.
The writer says it's as if the city is shouting at him, "Are you crazy? Get out of here!"
But if you don't listen to the voice, and if you stay, then you will discover the small miracles of this city.
It's in search of those small, quiet miracles that the character, Inspector Kostas Haritos, spends many hours in his car battling Athens' notorious traffic and its polluted and clogged roadways. Markaris' books are filled with the names of streets and squares. He's been hailed as the master writer of traffic jams. Markaris was born in Istanbul in 1937 to a Greek-Armenian family. He studied economics in Vienna. He speaks several languages. When he decided to become a writer, he chose Greek as his creative tool, and he made Athens his home in 1965. He has written plays for the theater, scripts for movies, and poetry. Then he decided to write about contemporary Greek society.
You want to write today a social or political novel, you have to turn to the crime novel.
The character of the police inspector was a challenge for a writer with left-wing sympathies. In the Balkans, Markaris says, especially in countries that have had dictatorships like Greece, policemen are seen as fascists.
So when I decided that Haritos was my character, I said, how can I write about a right-wing policeman when I hate them?
He decided to take the character's uniform off, and what he found was very familiar.
And what I discovered was somebody like the people in my family. And this helped me to come very close to this character. Now we are the best friends, of course, but it took some time.
To further humanize Haritos, Markaris took a real anecdote he was told by a man who had been in prison during the junta years. This is how the former prisoner described a young policeman who offered cigarettes and comfort to men tortured in their cells.
He was running a bigger risk than us. If they caught him, his life would be much worse than ours. These are the small errors.
Markaris says his own cosmopolitan background allows him to view Greek society from a distance without sentimentality.
I mean, readers ask me sometimes, what is common between you and Haritos? Say, you know, the way of observing Greece and the Greeks. This is the point where Haritos and myself, we are the same person.
Inspector Haritos and Markaris have grown to resemble each other also in other ways. They both like to read dictionaries, and their favorite food is stuffed peppers. In the 6 novels written so far, Inspector Haritos confronts crimes and murders in various settings. The world of competitive TV in Deadline in Athens, shady money deals in third division soccer clubs in zonal defense, and corruption in public work contracts ahead of the 2004 Summer Olympics, Inche committed suicide. In the latest novel, Expiring Loans, Charitos comes face to face with the financial crisis that has been rocking Greece for the last 2 years. The four murder victims are linked to banks, hedge funds, and a rating agency. All of them are decapitated, a symbolic punishment for what the murderer sees as his victim's responsibility in poisoning Greece into financial ruin. Inspector Charitos himself is outraged by the draconian austerity measures, which he considers economically irrational, that the European Union has imposed on debt-burdened Greece and other southern European countries. So much so that when he decides to hand in his decrepit 40-year-old Fiat, he opts not for a German or French make, but rather, in a sign of solidarity, he buys a Spanish-made Seat. It is through the Charitos novels that Márquez has been tracking the big transformations in European societies over the last two decades.
What changed the European crime novel is money, is the financial crime. And what we are seeing in Greece today is financial crime.
The turning point in the European crime novel, Márquez says, was the fall of communism in the East and the opening up of borders.
It's a globalized communism. It's all over the world. And governments are just looking away at the cleaning process of this money. Then the flow of this cleaned money into the regular financial system is so big that nobody dares to touch it. And this is a big, topic of the modern European crime novel.
Such vast sums of ill-gotten money, Márquez fears, could lead to small countries like Greece losing control of their destiny. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News.
Many who have been bullied will tell you a good book can help heal the pain, a story that tells you you're not alone and this won't last forever. Author Justin Torres came across just such a book many years ago. Here he is for our series, You Must Read This.
In 1995, when I was a sophomore in high school, an older, popular boy came out of the closet. He was taunted daily until he dropped out. I never saw him again. Months later, a decidedly unpopular, more flamboyant boy was beaten in the schoolyard. I remember escorting him to the nurse's office. I remember the look of disgust on the nurse's face. I don't know whether this disgust was directed at the fact of such savagery or at the bleeding boy himself. I also remember thinking that soon it would be my turn, and sure enough, it was. That same year, 1995, saw the publication of Dream Boy. In it, Jim Grimsley confronts the violence of adolescent homophobia. But also, and maybe more importantly, he describes the emotional texture, the loneliness of growing up queer, and the bravery and special intensity of finding love in a hostile environment. I wish, back then, someone had put this book in my hands. I didn't come to Dream Boy until nearly a decade later, when I met the writer Dorothy Allison. She insisted that it wasn't enough just to write the violence, that we needed to write the tenderness as well. Read Grimsley, she said. He was one who got it right. Dream Boy tells the story of Nathan and Roy. Nathan's troubled family relocates to a new home on Roy's family farm. Nathan is smart, shy, and slight. Roy is 2 years older, strong, and popular. He is pulled gravitationally toward Nathan. The first half of the book is written with devastating beauty. The second half of Dream Boy takes us to a haunted house, and the book becomes a ghost story. This is a brilliant, unexpected turn, and Dream Boy is like no other book I've ever read. I won't say too much more here, because you must read this book, but I will say that Grimsley realizes literature is not bound to the laws of the physical world, and he makes the most of this. We find violence and tragedy here, and some have labeled this book Southern Gothic. But as Flannery O'Connor said, I once received a letter from an old lady in California who informed me that when the tired reader comes home at night, he wishes to read something that will lift up his heart. And it seems her heart had not been lifted up by anything of mine she had read. I think that if her heart had been in the right place, it would have been lifted up. There is something of a national conversation going on about adolescent sexuality and bullying. Nothing I have heard can touch the beauty and eloquence of Dream Boy. no argument for compassion is as convincing. And if you've suffered or are suffering from bullying, no platitude is as salutary as reading and rereading this book. So read Dream Boy, if your heart is in the right place.
Justin Torres is the author of the book We the Animals. You'll find more summer reading recommendations at the Summer Books page at npr.org.
Let's turn a few more pages in our series, Crime in the City, about crime novelists and the places they write about. This week, we're going to venture overseas, starting with our own David Green. And David, we should mention for people who aren't familiar that when you're not here in the studio with us, you are our correspondent in Moscow.
That's right. And that's where I was, in the Russian capital, Moscow, earlier this summer, where I met an author named Tom Rob Smith. And he was actually on his first visit to Moscow since he was a teenager. He's written these thrillers that are set mostly in the Soviet Union of the 1950s. Mm. His protagonist is this Soviet security agent whose job really is to spy on fellow citizens. And the Moscow that he writes about in his first book, it's called Child 44, is this oppressive place. Today, Moscow's a city that's changed for the most part, I would say. And I took the author first to this lovely garden that was full of music and children eating cotton candy.
We're in the Hermitage Gardens. It's very un-Child 44, this music.
This city, the parks and the gardens can be so pleasant, and these spaces.
When I drove in from the airport, passing the parks, you know, there was a real sense of people enjoying the sun. They're very beautiful, quite big, very green. And I think that must have been the relief, I think, from the claustrophobia. It must have been in the parks. It's why I don't have any scenes in parks, maybe, in my books.
Claustrophobia is an important part of the...
Yeah, I guess, you know, here is that. As soon as you move into outside space, I guess you start feeling more relaxed.
And Tom Rob Smith doesn't want you to relax. Fear is what makes you keep turning the pages of his books. We follow his protagonist, government agent Leo Demidov, into the darkest corners of the Soviet Union, the gulags, torture chambers. And in Moscow, to underground subway stations like this one. If Smith's characters are fictional, his settings are largely realistic still today.
A gust of warm air blew down the crowded platform. The train was approaching. As everyone turned to watch, Leo caught sight of a man looking in the opposite direction, away from the oncoming train, directly at him. Leo had never seen him before, yet he knew immediately this man was a fellow Czechist, a state security operative. There was a second agent on the platform.
You want to talk about timing? You feel the rush of warm air before that train came in?
To capture details like that warm rush of air, Smith researched a lot. The 31-year-old author lives in London. His only previous visit to Moscow was a 1997 high school trip, years before deciding to write these books. And so amazingly, his portrayal of Moscow life came from reading. He did visit other locations to write his novels, but not Moscow. And while he doesn't advise authors to do it that way, he says spending too much time researching a place in person can distract you from your plot.
Because you take such copious notes when you're there. You take enormous amount of detail, you video it, you photograph it, and so you get back to your desk and you're like, I've got all this information, I know exactly what everything looks like, and you pile it all in, and then you cut that all out because you've really got to follow the story.
When his story brings us through Moscow, we're not taken to the Kremlin or to the city's colorful Orthodox churches. Instead, Smith captures how hard life was for citizens in the 50s. And on this visit, he wanted a taste for everyday life today.
You know, you see people queuing for a bank here. There would have been queues for shops, food shops in the 50s. That's where the story is really set, with extraordinary pressures, but we're not really exploring the people taking those higher-level decisions. We're exploring the effect on people who live around here, the people we see now.
Life is pleasant today for Muscovites who have money. It's become one of the most expensive cities in the world, with uppity boutiques and fancy hotel lobbies with pianos and $15 cappuccinos. We escaped that side of Moscow.
So if we do it Moscow style, we just wave down an old Russian car and make a price, and he can take us around.
A real tour of this city means riding in an old Russian Lada. The boxy Soviet-era cars are often driven by older men who blare their music and chat up a storm.
Вот я так думают многие люди. all these fancy stores and expensive restaurants, they are not for ordinary people.
We packed into the car with our translator, Sergei Sotnikov. Our author, crammed in the back seat, listened as our driver talked about his grandfather being arrested in 1939. He had been ordered to relocate and work on a collective farm, and he refused. Our driver's grandfather was tortured and died.
Not here, not in Lubyanka, because I think he says that the prison was somewhere in Siberia.
When we asked our driver for his name, he got quiet. And Tom Rob Smith saw how the Moscow that filled the pages of his books is still alive in people's memories.
It was really strange. It was strange to feel that now and imagine that must have just been everyone's reaction back then.
One powerful symbol of the past is the Lubyanka building, a few blocks from the Kremlin. Today, it's the headquarters of the FSB, Russia's modern domestic security force. In Soviet times, the agency went by different names. For a long time, it was KGB. Smith wrote about the brownish building, how the top level has no windows, just a small clock, as he wrote, that gazes over the city like a beady eye.
There was no chance you could be found innocent inside these walls. It was an assembly line of guilt. Perhaps Lubyanka hadn't been constructed with fear in mind, but fear had taken over all the same.
And fear was the weapon used by Agent Leo Demidov. Smith's character had blood on his hands, the blood of innocent men and women who may have been arrested simply for having lunch with the wrong people or writing the wrong words in a diary. In Soviet times, they might have ended up here at Lubyanka.
Leo didn't know the precise execution capacity, but the numbers were high, up to several hundred a day. At those levels, practical considerations, such as how easily and quickly human remains could be cleaned away, became an issue.
In Smith's novels, Leo battles for redemption, always reminding himself that he became a Soviet agent because he loved his country.
Because you're not dealing with someone who is villainous. You're dealing with a hero, in a sense, who's had his heroism put in this strange direction that's made him do these terrible things. As a journey for him, he has to try and overcome that. He has to think, how do I put right the wrongs I've done? And that, to me, struggling against the mistakes you made is very interesting as a literary character, I think.
And maybe that's what makes Moscow interesting as a city. Like Leo, Moscow is on a journey to find a new identity and forget its dark past.
High school can be stressful, but reading about it doesn't have to be. Writer and actor Simon Pegg has a recommendation for his favorite book about that awkward time. It's for our series, You Must Read This, where authors talk about a book they love.
I was first made aware of Bruce Robinson at a party in 1987 when I was introduced to him by a friend. Bruce wasn't at the party. Why would he be? It was one of those teen affairs where everybody gets drunk on affordable alcohol, then swiftly disappears into various rooms for sexual experimentation. This party was perhaps a tad more sophisticated than others, in that it featured a cinematic double bill. The first was Sam Raimi's slapstick horror masterpiece, Evil Dead 2. The second, a hitherto unknown quantity, called Withnail and I. Robinson's film was a revelation, a bittersweet story of two struggling actors at the cigarette butt of the 1960s who go on holiday by mistake. The film became an all-time favourite of mine thereafter, and I became a firm fan of writer-director Bruce Robinson. I was delighted in later years to discover his literary work, in particular his novel The Peculiar Memories of Thomas Penman. The story follows a bright but troubled young man through the precarious minefield of early adolescence in 50s Britain, a time when people were constipated with their own emotions and crippled by an inability to express themselves. Thomas's traumatic relationship with his parents and touching love for his dying grandfather form the backdrop to a tale which is both moving and side-splittingly hilarious. Beginning with a detailed account of Thomas's strange predilection for soiling his own underwear, the story introduces us to a very peculiar boy, a solitary individual on a quest to discover his grandfather's secret stash of bizarre pornography. He is despised by his father and teachers, regarded with frustrated impatience by his mother, and friend only to a similarly eccentric, chain-smoking youngster who happens to be the son of the local vicar. Piece by piece, he assembles the puzzle that is his turbulent home life, an existence made awful by the festering resentment of his parents. Yet amid this adversity, our affection for Thomas grows as he discovers the emotional turmoil engulfing him is simply not his fault. The Peculiar Memories of Thomas Penman is a book told with such dexterity and depth, it can be enjoyed for both its imagination and its craft.
That's writer and actor Simon Pegg. His new book is called Nerd Do Well, A Small Boy's Journey to Becoming a Big Kid.
Okay, parents, you've made it through those first years, through all those decisions, breastfeeding or bottle, mounted safety gate or removable, overpriced organic or pesticide-grown strawberries. But just when you're ready to look at your baby, now little person, and say, job done, you're faced with the most challenging problem of all, how to get him or her the best education you can. It wasn't always this way.
Well, there was a time when you could enroll your child in kindergarten and about 13 years later sit on one of those folding chairs and dab your eyes as they graduated from high school. And that's really changed.
That's education journalist Peg Tyer. Her new book is called The Good School, How Smart Parents Get Their Kids the Education They Deserve. And most parents know that quest begins even before preschool. And Peg Tyer says it's easy to get sidetracked.
All those kids look cute. All that artwork looks creative. That's not a good way to judge a preschool. One of the things you really want to do is you want to look at the relationship between teacher and student. What you want to see is teachers who have a lot of respect for kids, who seem to know their strengths and weaknesses. Those are the kind of rich relationships you want to see, because early teacher-student relationships are very, very significant to the outcomes for your child.
When you're choosing a good school for your child, one of the biggest concerns is, of course, the teachers. How do you spot a good teacher?
One of the myths that our schools are now struggling with is that all teachers are good. And in fact, the myth that they struggle with is that the first grade teacher can as easily teach fourth grade as she can sixth grade. Like, they're widgets. You can move them around and toss them into different classrooms at will. That's just not true. One of the things I would say is a teacher who is in their first year is not a wonderful sign for an effective instructor for your child. They tend to be passionate, enthusiastic, they have a lot of energy, but research tells us that they are not that effective in their first year. So the question is, what do you do? Do you demand that your child be taken out of that classroom? Well, that's going to create chaos in the school, especially if 10 parents do the same thing. But you can go to the principal and you can ask this question. Okay, I know the research says that a first-year teacher is not that effective. What are you doing to support that teacher this year just so that my child moves forward this year and is not just a guinea pig for your first-year teacher?
Some of the horror stories in the book had parents whose child was not at level, even in first or second grade. And they went into the school and said, I think there's kind of a problem here. My child really hates reading. And the schools did not respond well to that at all. What do you do in that situation?
That actually is not a sign of a neglectful parent. That actually happened to me. So I just want to say that I wish I had this research when I was raising my own oldest son. One of the things that concerns me the most, and I think it's one of the biggest warning signs, is when a child is falling behind in reading. Reading is the kingpin skill for school success. And we know that a third of children in our schools do not learn to read proficiently. So schools say, you know, don't worry, they'll catch up. Or one of my favorites, he's just a boy, boys learn later. Or, you know what, let's wait until he's a little farther behind and then we can get him to the X number special service reading specialist. That is not the answer that you want. You want to talk about specific skills that they're mastering and the ones that they're not mastering so that they can get this. Another year of the same bad instruction is not going to help your child.
A lot of parents know when they're on that school tour, when they're looking for a school, to ask about class size.
Class size seems to have been the one-size-fits-all desire of parents to have small class size all the way through. And when you look at the really substantive research on class size is very significant from kindergarten to third grade. After third grade, there's less of an impact on academic outcome.
This is the back-to-school time. What are a couple warning signs that parents should look for in these next few days as they bring their children back to school?
Well, generally the first couple of days are a happy time when everyone's pretty enthusiastic about it. The real fall off will be in about 3 weeks' time when your child doesn't want to get out of bed. But seriously, what you need to look for is a very well thought out curriculum around reading, around math. You want teachers who are bringing those subjects in at all grades. You want teachers who are all engaged in best practices so that they're not learning how to be teachers to the detriment of your child. You do want a school day for your child that's the right balance of seat time and recess. That's very, very important. And school administrators know that children need to move around, but they also know they need to maximize instructional time. And they're trying to figure out what the best use of the school day is and how to fit all those things in to keep children learning and learning well.
That's Peg Tyer, author of the new book, The Good School. She joined us from our studios in New York. Peg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A good book doesn't have to be science fiction to transport us to distant worlds. A new anthology of stories called The Lotus Singers accomplishes that. It features the work of writers from a variety of South Asian countries, and Alan Chews finds the author's perspectives well worth visiting.
First, let me do some numbers for you. The Lotus Singers gives us nearly 20 contemporary pieces of short fiction from a number of South Asian nations, mainly India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bhutan, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh. Stories either written in English or translated by various hands from the Urdu, Bengali, Hindi, Gujarati, Bangla, and Marathi. None of the writers included here in this volume has much, if any, reputation at all in the U.S., but their subjects are pressing. Hunger, rape, feudal oppression, struggle among castes and social classes, the struggle of women to achieve a modicum of equality, civil war, overbearing matters, yes. But there's some incidental joy here, too, as in the powerful story Emancipation, written originally in Urdu by Pakistani writer Hassan Manzar, in which we read of the emotional and legal turmoil of an Indian wife on a pilgrimage. She's assaulted on a train by a conductor, but just before that life-changing event, the train crosses a bridge over the Ganges, and the woman notices how the orange iron girders suddenly rose to high heaven and just as swiftly swooped back down, reverberating with strange noises. Just then, she says, "I would think of all the kids in our city who had never seen a bridge sway in this manner. They could not have been more unfortunate." And there's the bliss that comes with understanding in the story by the Delhi writer Manjula Padmanabhan called A Government of India Undertaking. Here the narrator discovers one of life's great mysteries in an office filled with paper documents about birth and death. No tour like a serious anthology such as this one to show you how a distant part of the world seems so foreign and yet so close to home.
The book is The Lotus Singers, a collection of stories from South Asia. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.